Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro, and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. My guest is Rick Fox, and he's probably most known for working with the band Wasp, Steeler, and Sin. But he also, I was reading his bio, he's played with a lot of different people as a session player, and one of my favorites, Sam Kinison, who's known more for, as a comedian, but he was great. And then Spiders and Snakes and Little Steven and more. So I'm going to play a clip in a minute. Welcome, Rick. It's great to have you on the show. It's really an honor to have you here.
And thank you so much, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Okay, the clip I'm going to play right now, which will kind of set up things, it's called Ain't Gonna Eat Out My Heart, which was in a song by the Rascals. And this was like a, there was a lot of famous people, a lot of famous musicians playing on this thing, right? If I'm correct?
Not on this particular cut, but what happened was there was a band out of the, in the 80s called Angel. Mm-hmm. They were a huge influence on me. This was one of the cover songs that they did on one of their albums. It was The Rascals, Ain't Gonna Eat Out My Heart Anymore. Mm-hmm. In their attempt to write more commercially viable songs and getting away a little bit from the castles and the knights and the medieval themes. And when I was hanging around with Spiders and, well, just before I was hanging out with Spiders and Snakes, I was with them for a little while and I left. And then 10 years later, I got a call from the drummer and he says, hey, you know, do you want to come and play on our new album? And I said, okay. And they set it up and they had already recorded the song with the basic tracks. They wanted me to come in and lay the bass tracks over that. And I found out that upon learning the song in one key, the key that Angel was doing it in, I get to the studio to find out that the guitar player had transposed it. And he changed the entire key of the song. So I had to like relearn it on the spot. And, mm-hmm. and we recorded it and did a couple of passes and we got it down. And essentially what I tried to do to stay true to the roots of the Angel version, because that's where they were going with it, I played Felix Robinson's bass tracks pretty much note for note, and did all the walks and everything in there like that. And then, and because I wasn't there when they did the basic tracks with the drums, he didn't know that there was an accent part that comes up later in the song between the bass and it's like a bump, 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 you know, a little push there, mm-hmm. accents. And he didn't play those, so I played them anyway. But and then it was a kind of a twist on the song because instead of a guy singing it to a girl, We had a guest female singer, Betsy, from the band Bitch, mm-hmm. and it became a call and answer, a he said, she said. So they're singing it both from the guy to the girl aspect, and then they turn it so she's singing it from the girl to the guy aspect. So, and that's pretty much what we did.
Well, let me play this clip. If I'm correct, this is live, right?
No.
Oh, it isn't live, because it sounds like it was live. But anyway, mm-hmm. let me play the clip, and we'll talk a little bit more. Here it is, Ain't Gonna Eat Out My Heart.
Yeah!
That's a great cut. That's a great song, anyway. I remember the original.
It is, yeah.
So who was playing? Okay, Betsy was singing on there, so who else was on that?
The drummer, Tim Yasui, Timothy J., he was the other singer doing the lead vocals. Spiders and Snakes came out of a band that was legendary in London, in L.A. called London, which was put together by Nikki Sixx and Lizzie Gray. Mm-hmm. And over the years, London has become one of the significant bands, rotating doors of members over the... And people who've been in London go on to do other bigger things, like Slash and Fred Corey from Cinderella, things like that. So Lizzie was still in the band, and it was Timmy. And then the guitarist Chris Sheridan from a Texas band called Sweet Savage, who used to be kind of big in the Hollywood era. And then they had a guest keyboard player come in. I think his name was Lewis. I'm not sure. I just met him like once or twice, you know. And then upon doing the cut, once the album was done, Tim called me up. And he said, "Hey, you know, our bass player is taking a personal hiatus. Do you want to come do some shows with us?" So this happens all the time in the music industry. You know, you play on somebody's session and they ask you to play some live dates. And I wound up doing a whole bunch of live dates with Spiders and Snakes. And, you know, local Hollywood clubs, things like that. And we did a gig in Hollywood at a club called Loaded, I think it was, with Thor, who's an old friend of mine from back in the New York, New Jersey days. So Thor was still together, and we did it. And it was packed.
That's so great.
So, yeah.
Well, now you mentioned two things. First of all, you mentioned that it was a song that Angel covered, which was one of your favorite bands growing up.
Yeah.
And then also to The Rascals, which was a East Coast, if I'm correct, a New York band. Now, you were originally from New York.
That's correct.
Right. So let's talk a little bit of your background and your roots, because you were there at the time where there was a major music scene happening at that time.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, what happens was I was a foot messenger in Manhattan, and I'm sitting in front of the Seagram's building one day, and I had, you know, this Rod Stewart rooster haircut, I guess that's what they called it. And this girl comes walking by, and she had the same haircut. And she's like, "Hey, we have the same haircuts." One thing leads to other. We start talking, and she says, "Hey, have you ever been to Max's Kansas City?" Which was a legendary club. It came out of the art scene, the Andy Warhol art scene. And a lot of early successful bands play. Alice Cooper played there. Aerosmith played there. Lots of big bands play there. Showcasing, and I said, "No, I've never." She's, "You never heard of Max's Kansas?" "That's it, we're going." And she had me meet her down there at 17th Street, Park Avenue South. And I walked into Max's Kansas City, and it was like that was my first step going down what I call the rabbit hole. And it was a whole new element open to me. I had been to other clubs earlier in Queens, Coventry, and such, because I was involved with, I was one of the first people to see Kiss form. Before Ace Frehley was in the band. So I was dating one of Peter Criss's sisters. And so we used to go watch Kiss rehearse. And so I got kind of hip to the music scene by the bands they played with at the Diplomat and Coventry, the Bratz, the Planets, Luger, Perfect Stranger, you know, all these bands from the New York Dolls, things from that whole scene. And I started to rub shoulders with them. And I'm still in high school. This is 1972.
Wow.
So by the time I'm out of high school, 75, you know, I got to the whole world of Max's open to me, and then from there CBGB and the whole schmear like that. So the girl introduced me to a guitar player who had a band, and he played the club a few times, and his name was Sebby Castle. Today he's called Sebastian Black. He's a psychic mentalist magician in New York. But at the time, Sebby, we met, and he said, "Hey, you know, you play bass?" I said, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, we're looking to replace our bass player." So he took a chance on me, you know, and I wasn't that good. I was
well.
Still
had
green.
You been playing already, or you just started picking it up?
I was still a little green. I hadn't played live with anyone anywhere. You know, I was just practicing down the basement to records. That's kind of I never took any lessons. My parents didn't have the money for formal music lessons. I'm a street guy. I just learned from playing with guitar players. So like that. And then so I rehearsed with them. I got the gig. I rehearsed with them at a famous rehearsal building on 30th Street, Manhattan. And my professional debut in front of a paying audience was Halloween 1975 at Max's Kansas City with a group called the Martian Rock Band. and we were supporting Neon Leon's Rainbow Express, Leon coming from Philadelphia. And that was my introduction to the scene. And from that point on, from doing shows and hanging out at Max's, I got to rub shoulders with the Ramones, Wayne County, Tough Darts, Richard Hell, Voidoids, everybody who was somebody at Max's, I got to be friends with. So I was a regular there.
Well, even like when you were hanging around the early pre-Kiss and also some of the other bands that you were selling, what, you know, like for example with, well, let's take Kiss for example, was that sound that they're famous for now, were they really doing that at that time, or were they just more like a regular hard rock band, or could you hear that where they were going, or were they kind of just kind of evolving? And then also too, the bands that you were listening to at these clubs and stuff, because you're talking about, besides punk, you're talking about glam rock.
Exactly.
And there's a whole, yeah, that's a whole style in itself besides the look, but they're musically. So can you elaborate on
that? Well, there was a newspaper that came out of England called Melody Maker, and, mm-hmm, and a lot of the musicians in New York would get that paper. I was getting the papers. So we would kind of keep up on what was hip and happening and coming out of England. And Rod Stewart and Small Faces, if you look at on the back album, backside of the album, Not As Good As a Wink to a Blind Horse, they're all made up like marionettes.
Mm-hmm.
And they have these rooster haircuts. And that became a fashion trend. Paul McGregor was the first person, I believe, to introduce that layered feathered haircut to the fashion world. Jane Fonda was one of the first people to get it. And then everybody's in the Hollywood genre started getting these feathered layered haircuts. So the musicians in New York started to do this, and I followed in suit, just like all of them. To, you want to fit in, you have to look like, you know, like these guys and whatnot. So I had my hair. Peter Criss did my first layered rooster haircuts.
Oh wow!
Like that, so. This was an element that a lot of the bands in New York were trying to look like, this English glam scene. The Bratz looked exactly like Rod Stewart and the Small Faces. They even had a guitar player that looked like Ronnie Wood. He had the nose, the black hair, the layered, like that. So a lot of bands started to copy and emulate that English glam scene,
mm-hmm,
that first wave of English glam. And I just did my best as I could to fit in with that. Now, as far as Kiss, I was completely unprepared for a band like Kiss. I mean, we were at their loft, we were watching them rehearse, and as I said, it was before Ace Frehley was in the band. And just the trio, once Peter got the gig, which is how we used to go there, Peter,
right,
would pick us up in his wife's car, Lydia's car, and we go and watch them rehearse in this dingy little loft, and I had never seen or heard anything. I can just say it was like melodic thunder. You know, they were Gene and Paul were really big into the Beatles and the Stones and whatnot, and they would write really catchy but heavy songs, you know, Strutter and Nothing to Lose and Firehouse and Cold June. I'd never heard anything like this before. It was just we sat there with our jaws open, you know, and once we went up there and there was a guy in a gray pinstripe suit with a purple sneaker and an orange sneaker, and he's leaning with his back against the wall and he's just playing these ripping leads. And Gene and Paul are like nudging him to move, and he didn't want to move. He's leaning against, that was Ace Frehley, you know, and he was the final piece in the puzzle that made Kiss. And we used to go see them, like I said, at the Diplomat and Coventry and Sunshine Inn, Asbury Park on their way up, and it was just it was an amazing thing to be part of the magic of all of this unfolding in front of my eyes. I was exposed to so much integral bits and pieces that would later come into what I was doing on stage.
Right, right.
Yeah, like that.
Well, most people, when they think of the glam rock movement and what was happening there, automatically just think of the look. But how would you describe the style of the music? Was there a definite style to it, like punk or hard rock or metal, or was it a combination of it, or, you know?
Yeah, I'd have to say it wasn't punk, I know that. There were elements of aggression in the music, but not punk. It was, I think a lot of it was based essentially off the blues formation, blues patterns.
So it was blues-based, you
blues
would say.
Blues-based, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But heavy, they'd crank up the volume. You know, I'd say, you know, what happens when you turn the blues up to 11? You get Led Zeppelin, you know. So that's what these guys were doing, you know. So if you turn up Stay With Me by Rod Stewart, Small mm-hmm. Faces, and you crank that, it becomes heavy. You know, the chord structures they're using, the arrangements they're using. You know, out of the 60s, bands were coming out of where they used to have orchestral arrangements and horns and strings over the guitars and the drums, because it was like light pop, things like that. But as the writers started to separate from the artists wanted to represent themselves more, like the Monkees, and write their own material. And more the horns and the brass and the strings started to become something in the background, to where it was deleted entirely, and it was just the band themselves playing.
Right.
You know, so...
Well, how were you influenced, too? Because I remember, in terms of... you were there at the time when Hendrix was coming out and Cream came out, and, well, you mentioned Zeppelin. Mm. How did that influence you, or was it you were more influenced by the scene that you were, because you were in the scene, but they were there too, weren't they?
I can tell you the first time I heard Ted Nugent's Amboy Dukes playing Journey to the Center of the Mind, mm-hmm. I was down in the basement with a broom, like it was the guitar,
mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
know. And a lot of guitar players I know can relate to that. Mm-hmm. Punky Meadows from Angel said when he first heard Elvis, he got the tennis racket, like he was playing it like a guitar. So there was something about the music and the way the arrangements were that affected you physically. Your body would interpret the music a certain way. That's something I've carried with me to this day, is interpreting the music physically. And the way these songs were coming out, especially the more aggressive ones, struck a really, no pun intended, struck a chord with me. You know. And the first two albums I ever received when I turned 13 was The Beatles' Rubber Soul, which had just come out, and the first Steppenwolf album, which had just come out. What an introduction to music. This is before I was old enough to go to clubs and whatnot. So I became a staunch Steppenwolf fan ever since then. I'd seen them on American Bandstand and whatever TV shows they were on. And my first bass idol, Nick St. Nicholas, in his buckskin fringe jacket and his bell bottoms, and he's got a Rickenbacker bass, and he's just playing, nodding his head back and forth. Something about that told me that is the epitome of cool. Yeah. And I want to do what he's doing. I want to be what he is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's how I became interested in playing bass. You know, so that's what kind of where it came from for me.
Now, what... let's talk a little bit more about, as you started gigging and stuff, the earlier stuff, were you in, was it more of a metal thing at, or was metal there at the time, or was it your early days gigging?
Metal,
what kind of stuff were you playing?
I think metal really didn't become a genre. I mean, there was loud, heavy music. It was Blue Cheer, and Steppenwolf, of course, was heavy. Amboy Dukes were heavy. Cactus was heavy. But it wasn't called metal then. You know, everything was still kind of based off of bluesy kind of, you know, formations and roots and things like that, arrangements. After I got out of Martian Rock Band, I wound up in Jersey playing with a cover band there, a big club cover band called Virgin. And this is the original Virgin. And we did pretty much an English glam thing. So again, we're going back to whatever the English glam music was. Mata Hoople. We did an Alice Cooper show with the Snake. We did a Bowie set. We did Kiss. We did the Zeppelin. We did whatever was popular. I mean, that we could wear what we wore on stage and still portray the music. And we had 8-inch platform boots, skin tight, mm-hmm. Outfits. My singer looked a little, at that time, Ian Chris, he resembled Bowie a little bit, but he put the black makeup on his eyes. He'd look like Alice Cooper, and a girl would loan him a boa and we'd like that. So we were playing pretty much the English glam stuff, you know, that was coming from over there, Sweet, Slade, things like that. And so metal didn't really come in until... Alice Cooper, the album with 18 on, I Love It to Death, had some really heavy crunching guitars, but it still wasn't called metal yet.
Right.
I think Kiss was one of the first bands, at least in my exposure to it, represented what could be called metal.
Really?
But
because I always felt that, like, you know, when you heard a lot of the what we would term metal bands, like you'd have like Yngwie playing and stuff. To me, it wasn't as blues-based. It was more classically based, because they would do all these like arpeggios and runs. And harmonically, they weren't doing a lot like Zeppelin or, you know, Cactus, or which was very blues-based, which to me was the category hard, I guess, would be now hard rock. Or, you know, because that was the Who, the Cactus, Cream, all of that was blues-based hard rock. I mean, did you see that? Because I think you played with Yngwie, didn't you?
Yeah,
play
Steeler, yeah. Well, you know, a lot of the stuff that the English bands were playing was they were copying from the American, the black blues artists.
Right, right.
You know, like Zeppelin did and whatnot, you know, The Who and whatever, you know, and Cream. They just crank up the volume, you know, and you had Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page smashing guitars, and there became a theatrical aspect to it, you know, and which picked up and evolved from there. Bands like Deep Purple and Uriah Heep were called, you know, the early fathers of metal because of their volume, but they still were not like a metal type arrangement. That didn't start to come in, I think, until the 80s, because coming out of the 60s into the 70s, guitars and bass players still pretty much played a lot of the same lines together, the melody lines. It wasn't until the 80s I started noticing that the bass and the drums would just kind of lock in and just play kind of a really elemental root arrangement, and the guitars would play all the passing chords over that. And that's where a lot of it started to change. The arrangements became very different. And even bands like Rat and Armored Saint, they weren't really... I mean, I don't think they were metal, but because of the sheer volume, it became metal. You know, things like that. You know.
Well, let me play... I'm going to play a clip that you did with Wasp, and it kind of shows that kind of driving... that driving bass where it kind of locks in with the drum. This is Bad, and we'll talk a little bit about it because I want to get into your tone and sound. So this is Bad, and this is Wasp.
It's a B-A-D.
B-A-D, I'm sorry. Now you can hear. I mean, you're doing this driving bass line, and it's locking in with the drums. Now, a lot of the stuff that I've heard of that you had sent me a bunch of clips. A lot of the stuff you lock in a lot, and you got a lot of stuff going on with the guitars. So I noticed that you play a lot. You're playing more simple. You're not getting busy. You don't get busy in there. Do you ever get the opportunity in that format of music to play against? Have you ever tried playing against, or does it work? Or,
well, it depends who the songwriter is. You know, I was playing some. You know, when I came out to audition for Wasp, and I was at Blackie's invitation, and I sat there in the rehearsal studio, and they went through the set, and they had me watch, and they said, okay, now you come up and try out and play. And I was still playing, you know, melodic stuff. I had come from playing six nights a week in cover bands in Jersey, you know, like with the E. Walker Band or with Aggressor, you know. And we're playing everybody else's tunes, the top 40 of heavy metal, Scorpions and Van Halen, Iron Maiden and whatnot. So I was playing other people's material. So whatever the song called for, I played. But in terms of Wasp, Blackie had asked me a couple of times, can you play simpler?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They wanted me to not be... Even just doing a you know, a walk was sometimes... He'd look at me and I'm like, all right, keep it simpler. But I would listen to what the arrangement was doing and then try to fit in accordingly to how I interpreted what was going on without overstepping, I guess you may call it, what he was looking for in the terms of the rhythm section. So I just pretty much locked in with Tony on drums like that. And I have a thing where when I'm playing with a drummer, I can like anticipate what he's going to do based on the arrangement of what he's playing. And drummers I've played with, I find, really appreciate that. You know, some bass players just turn their back to the drummer and it's the audience the whole night. I, on the other hand, I like to make eye contact with the drummer, and I know there's an accent coming, and we both accentuate those, and they love that. They love that. So I would do that with Tony, with Wasp, you know, and like in the beginning where
go ahead and play the riff.
Yeah, he's doing that bass line, and I'm just going, you know, going up to the octave, just riding on the A like that. But this accent where I go to. I took back when I was in Steeler, when we did Cold Day in Hell, it was in G, and the same thing. I'm going, you know, as the guitars are doing the passing tone. So it's just something I just borrowed back from myself. But in the pre-choruses or choruses in BAD, when I'm going, you know, and I'm doing this little, just a little patterned walk in there. And I did try not to overdo it, so, you know, it wouldn't interfere with whatever Blackie's arrangement was in there.
Now, with some of the bands that you were playing with the guitar players, did they want you to, like Hendrix used to do, he would have the bass follow what he was doing on the guitar. Would they specifically ask you to follow something? Or
no, not
pretty much
the style of music.
They just let you...
You know, Leslie West did that with Mountain. You know, the guitar and bass pretty much followed the same thing, like in Mississippi Queen or you know, Never in My Life. You know, they play the same thing. But like I said, when the styles changed in the 80s, it was just lock in with the bass, play the eighths, play the quarter notes. On occasion, if it calls for, play the 16ths, but or you know, if you're Iron Maiden, 30 seconds or whatever, but you know, and let the guitars do all the passing tones and play the melodies that way.
Right. Well, did they leave in that style of music? Would they leave a hole for you to do something? I mean, obviously, in a concert situation, you have your solo or whatever. Mm. But I mean, in certain songs, would they give you a place to put a riff or whatever? Or for the most part, it was dominated by the guitars.
It just comes down to listening to the song when it's being written. If a guitar player says, "Well, I got this idea," and you sit down with him, and you have that liberty, luxury to sit down with him, you know, you can insert and do whatever you'd like. In the case of a song we'll come up later, "Gypsy Brandy." I was influenced by watching Whitesnake video "Still of the Night," and I said, "I want to write a song that sounds like Whitesnake." And I wound up what we used to call it the Whitesnake song until I came up with it. Well, I wrote the lyrics and came up with the title. But you know, I'm playing all kinds of melody in there because it was my song and I got to do whatever I wanted in there. But I didn't overplay. I didn't underplay. I played exactly. That's the key, is playing exactly what the song calls for.
Right.
And guitar players, some guys tend to forget about playing what the song calls for because in their interpretation it calls for more guitar.
Right.
You know.
Well, let's talk. We're going to play at the end of the night or the end of the show. I'm going to play the, because I have a good sized clip of Gypsy Brandy. Mm-hmm. But just for a minute, let's talk about the aspect of you writing it. Now, in this situation, in the Wasp situation, they brought you in like a session player, more or less, and they're saying, we want, he was very specific what he wanted, right?
He just said, keep it simple.
Keep it simple.
Yeah.
Now, turn it around to Gypsy Brandy, where you're writing the tune. How did you approach that? Did you tell the guitarist you wanted specific things? Did you make room for the bass to do a certain thing? Or how did you approach it?
I was blessed with having one of the best guitar players I'd ever played with. It's a guy named Joey Mazzola. He went on to be in a group called Sponge for a couple of albums, and then he was in Detroit Cobras. We've lost contact with each other, and he doesn't really respond to anyone anymore. He's back in Detroit. But while we played together, and I was called up from one of the booking agents at the Troubadour in Hollywood, and he said, there's a guitar player in town who's looking for you. And I said, what did I do? He says, no. He says, he wants to play with you. I said, okay. He says, I didn't give him your personal information. Here's his information. You can contact him. I said, okay, thanks. And I called him up. He was just new in town. And he said, yeah, I read about you, that you were friends with Guns N' Roses and all these other bands, and you jammed with this band and that band. And, you know, you seem like a happening guy, and you're a bass player, so I'd like to, you know, look you up. And I said, let me see your tape. Let me see a photo. What do you look like? He's, within a day or so, I had a photo, you know, black and white photo of him. He looked real good. He had musicians from the Midwest, especially in Michigan, Detroit, and Chicago, have a very cool look about them. And he had a very cool look about himself. He reminded me a lot of Jim McCarty from Cactus. I love that style. And his tape blew me away. He sounded like a cross between Michael Schenker and George Lynch.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, what a combination. So I invited him over, and next thing you know, we start writing songs. It was like we just hit it off. And eventually, he wound up moving in and becoming one of my roommates. So we had access to do what right any time. Mm-hmm. You know, any time the muse struck us, we got inspired. I'd say, hey, I got an idea, and we'd sit down and work on it right away. So in terms of Gypsy Brandy, like I said, I was influenced a little bit by the song Still of the Night, and that being already written, I wanted something that kind of reminded you a little bit of that kind of a style. And I was going for like a mysterious, you know, the fog at night and the whole mysterious thing and the chase of the girl. And then at the end of the song, it turns around and now you're after her, she's after you kind of a thing. And my drummer, Cecil, from Maryland, really, really good drummer. Not flashy, but solid. Solid drummer. I would say, you know, hey, in this part right here, can you give me a Cozy Powell? Because Cozy Powell was one of my favorite drummers. And I think, you know, like it's a bam, bam, brum, bam, bam, brum. That was one of Cozy's signature moves. And he put that in there. And I'd say, okay, can you, Joey, can you try this here? So I would throw it at the wall. I wouldn't say, you play this, you play. Yngwie would do that. He'd
right.
say, you play this, you play this, you play this, and that's it. But I would throw it at them and say, hey, can you try this? Can you try that? Can you try that? And they generally liked it, and it worked. That was the thing, is that it worked.
Yeah.
You know, so the writing for Gypsy Brandy came together really nicely.
Well, and again, since you had, you know, by the time you started recording Gypsy, you had been playing with Joey, and he had moved in, so you guys were, you're interacting, so you knew what he could do, and then it was more of intuitive, right?
Exactly.
It was more of
an
intuitive thing.
Yeah.
No, have you ever... when you've written stuff, have you ever gotten to the point, or you seem like you're pretty loose with it, like give me your best type of attitude, like, you know, you're putting the guitar player in there because of what he does, and you want to...
I like the team playing aspect.
Right.
You know,
but you don't find yourself needing to be more specific.
I just like working personally in you know, one-on-one with my musicians.
Right.
You know, and I like to... I get all kinds of arrangement ideas in my head. And that's why I say, you know, can you try this? Can you try that? And if I don't remember exactly what the technical term for the chord is or the pattern, I'll show it to him, you know, just on notes on the bass. And then within a second or so, he goes, oh, that, yeah, okay, that. And he gets that, you know, and I'll say, give me a double octave bend or something like that. And, you know, like, give me a Leslie West kind of a thing, you know, and they know exactly what I'm looking for. And that's pretty much how the songs come together.
Now, speaking of that, in terms of, okay, going from your songwriting, let's talk a little bit about your studio work, where you actually were called in as a hired gun, for example, like Kinnison or some of the other people that you had played with, would they just give you just do what you do, or were they very specific? Like, I mean, I don't.
What I did with Kinnison was I wasn't in the studio with them, but I played live.
Were you in the video?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, he had all the video guys, and he would be. If anyone was available, wherever he happened to be playing at whatever venue, if they were available, they would come down. You know, they'd get a call and he'd come down and be part of it. What happened was my manager at the time, Kenny Rubin, who was managing my band Thunderball, I got a call and he said, hey, you know, do you want to play with Sam Kennison? And I said, yeah. And he said, he's at the China Club. Get your bass. Get down here now. Now, the connection with that is that our manager was also managing Randy Hanson at the time. And Randy had was a Hendrix... he did a Hendrix show. Randy happened to be Sam's guitar player.
Oh, wow.
So there's the connection. And he said, yeah, Randy said, have Rick come down. So I went down there and I met Sam. And they said, you want to do the early show or the late show? And I said, I'll do the second show. And he said, okay, fine. So I'm downstairs in the downstairs bar / dressing room area. And the second set, after a while, starts. I'm going, wait a minute, I'm supposed to be on. Nobody let me. And I go upstairs, and there they are on stage. And it's Sam and Randy. On drums is who was with Ozzy Osbourne at the time, the late Randy Castillo.
Mm-hmm.
Great drummer. On guitar, Little Steven Van Zandt.
Mm-hmm.
On another guitar, Jean Beauvoir, who was the producer of the Plasmatics. Okay, he's a famous producer. John Goodman on harp, on blues harp. Three Sheets to the Wind.
right.
You know, it's right off of Roseanne, and Sam, and they're doing, you know, they're getting ready to do Wild Thing. Oh, and on bass is Jimmy Bain. So the bass roadie looks up there, and he looks at me, and he looks at Jimmy. He goes, "You're supposed to be on." I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Hang on a second." And then when they end stopped one of the songs, he grabs Jimmy, who is completely inebriated, pulls him off the stage, yanks the cord out of his bass, sticks it in my bass, and pushes me up. He goes, "Go!" And we launch into, Sam looks over and he sees that the bass is wild. We go into Wild Thing. And that was my experience of playing on stage with so many amazing legends. It was like, holy crap. You know, this is like one of my high points. You know, I mean, it's Sam, yes, and all of these other...
Yeah, legends. That's a pretty amazing band.
Yeah, with Stephen Van Zandt and Jean Beauvoir, yeah. You know, and Randy I knew from Ozzy Osbourne. But that was an amazing night. So that was my experience of playing with Sam. So that really wasn't a session thing. I did go to Phoenix, Arizona. I was friends with Loudness, and they were on tour. And the manager gave me some laminates. He goes, come to any show you want, you know. And I was out there watching Loudness play at Phoenix, and I got introduced to a guy named Jim Keeler, who was in a band called Surgical Steel.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know who they were, you know, just that he was interested in me. He knew that I played in Steeler. And by the time I got home the next day, I was just literally walked in the door, and my phone was ringing. And it was this local promoter who introduced me to Jim. He says, you got to come out here right now. You got to come back. Jim wants you in Surgical Steel. I said, I didn't even know anything about the band. And I made some other phone calls. And I said, who's Surgical Steel? He said, if you like Judas Priest, you'll like Surgical Steel. And Rob Halford lives in Phoenix at the time. And he goes to see them all the time. He gets up and jams with them. I said, oh, okay, I like Priest. So I went back out there, and they flew me out. And Jim Keeler says, here's the tape. He goes, Chief, here's the tape. Learn the songs. We're doing an album next week. I said, excuse me? I said, don't I audition? He goes, no, I don't, you know, I don't need you to audition. I know you can play. I heard the Steeler album. He goes, you're in the band. I just need you to learn the songs. And it was a crunch time, woodshedding, learning the songs. And then we did a couple of things I brought in. And we went in the studio to El Chitan in Phoenix. And Dan Wexler from Icon was producing. And we were recording the album. That was the session thing for me, recording the album with Surgical Steel. I thought this would be a great, you know, another feather in my cap and a notch in my belt. They were having problems with drummers. So since George Lynch lived out there, Mick Brown, his drummer from Dokken, was visiting. Mick came in, and Mick and I got to play together on a song, one of the songs I brought in. And Mick and I locked as if we came out of the womb together. I mean, it was that tight, like a machine. And we had the eye contact, the whole vibe was there. And when we were done with the song, Mick comes out, we come out of the room, and he goes, I don't know where all this crap comes from about you not being able to play. He goes, you're just as good as Jeff. Jeff Pilson. Which, you know, was very flattering. And he goes, you're a freaking good bass player, man. And I was very flattered coming from Mick Brown and got to play with him, and it was another feather in my cap, you know, getting to play with somebody, you know, respected in the industry and cool. And that's kind of pretty much how it was going from there. Before you get to it, though, I know I did perform on stage with Dio, but it wasn't playing bass.
Oh.
See, Dio had Jimmy and Vivian Campbell had written the song We're Stars for the Hearing Aid thing. Mm-hmm. And they brought all of these legendary famous musicians together to do this, and it was recorded and it was on video and you know, to feed the kid, the hungry people and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But you couldn't get all those people together every time Dio played that song. So we were all backstage, a bunch of us from Hollywood were hanging out backstage at Irvine Meadows for it was the Sacred Heart tour, and I'm standing backstage and Wendy Dio comes running up, grabs my elbow, literally drags me back from around the backstage or on the other side of the come out under the castle turret on Jimmy Bain's side, and it's Claude Schnell up in keyboards looking at, hey Rick, hey, and it was me, the guys from Poison and London and whoever else was backstage hanging out, any musicians from the LA scene, and we all got on stage and we did a live rendition of We're Stars. And that was my being able to play with Ronnie Dio on stage. The following weekend...
Now, you weren't playing bass, so you were singing?
No, we were singing.
You were singing.
The following weekend, Rough Cut was playing at the Country Club, and they did it again. And Ronnie came up, and this time there was a whole... Vince Neil and Paul Shortino and all these other people, whoever was in the VIP area. And they dragged us on stage... And I wound up finding myself being squeezed right next to Ronnie. And he took his mic, shoved it in my face, and goes, sing! And the cameras went off. And so I got twice to play, to perform. Mm-hmm. I was privileged to perform with Ronnie Dio on stage in that capacity.
Oh, that's, you know. Well, that's still cool.
That was another high point.
Yeah, no. Now, let's talk a little bit about what you use. Now, for example, with Wasp and Steeler, what was your guitar? What was your amps?
My gear with Wasp, I came out from Jersey with my, I had an Ibanez Destroyer bass. It was, you know, the Explorer body. Mm-hmm. Carina Wood. They were in the middle of some kind of patent lawsuit with Gibson over that, but that was my main bass that I played.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have an amp ready, because I just flew out. You know,
I
brought some, you know, I think a couple of bass heads with me, Ampeg bass heads.
SVTs?
I think they were V4Bs. I'm not sure. It's been a while. And I think we hocked them to get some money for something, for gear. Blackie had a deal going with this music store in Hollywood. Nadine's. Yeah.
Okay.
And a keyboard player from Legs Diamond, Michael Prince, helped us out with that. And so we were using a PV 118, mm-hmm. with, they called it a Black Widow.
Yeah.
And we'd plug it in, and I swear to you, there's no way we could have overdriven this thing. But I'm telling you, time and again, we'd get like a minute or two into a song and poof, and the speaker was blown. I mean, and this became a regular thing, and Blackie was getting pissed off because you had to go bring it back. It blew. Why? We don't know. Then we could never find out. We get another one, put it in, play a song, bam, it would blow out. So I think I wound up eventually borrowing something from someone, and I don't remember exactly what I was playing through, but I remember the incident with the PV Black Widow 18s, it just wasn't cutting it. It sounded cool, but it wasn't cutting it. In terms of Steeler, I was also blessed with being a good friend with Nikki Six. And when Motley Crue's money started to come in for Shout at the Devil, Nikki would call me up and say, hey, listen, if you want some of my gear, it's down at SIR in Hollywood. They've got your name. Go down and get it. It's yours. And he would give me.
That's so cool.
I'm telling you. You know, it doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and so I would go down to SIR, I'd find a ride, somebody get me, he had V4B cabinets with the folded horns in them, and powerful heads. I think
they had to be SVTs
or V4Bs. It might have been SVT, yeah. And he gave me his gear. He used to give me his old costumes. He gave me his red thigh-high stiletto boots, which I still have. And he would give me gear, literally, just here, you can have
now,
it.
You were still using the Destroyer at this time, or were you using...
Yes, yeah, okay. Yeah. And in all my Steeler pictures, you can see that. And then we got approached by Aria for Yngwie. They wanted Yngwie, you know. And so I guess out of courtesy or something, they said, well, do you want a bass too? I said, okay. And they had Explorer-shaped, body-shaped guitars. They had something called a ZZB bass. It was a blue sunburst. It was mm-hmm. kind of nice. But I'll tell you, when we went to record the Steeler album and we plugged it into the board, it was a day and night difference from playing it live. You can crank up however loud you want, but when it came to plug it into the board, the pickups were not... They couldn't get much of a signal.
Yeah.
The green lights were barely, you know, resonating.
Yeah.
I had to use a Precision that belonged... Precision bass belonged to the engineer. With really, 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 really old strings. He would refuse to change them. So that might explain some of the muddiness on the bass in the Steeler album. So I was playing this Aria bass, and then, and like that. So
when did you get to the Epiphone that you're using now?
Well, over the years, after I got out of Steeler, I approached Aria again, and they had done better with their pickups. And they had something called a ZZB blood bass. It was Aria Pro 2. It was an Explorer body. It was white and had blood splatter all over it. What they did was they took it off the line, and for me, they painted in the Japanese kanji, Gokuro Kitsune, which means like a crazy outlaw fox, they personalized it for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I played that. That was my primary bass through the post-Steeler but Sin era and on from there. When Sin was going into the studio to record album master demos, I got a copy of the tape, I went to BC Rich, and I had friends there. Spencer from the Sharks, Shark Island, he worked there, and I had a bunch of friends that worked there. Bernie, the late Bernie Rico Sr., we went out, we sat in his Cadillac, and we put the tape in. And about 30 seconds into the first song, Bernie looks at me and goes, "Welcome to BC Rich. What would you like us to make you?" And that was a milestone for me. I had never been asked that. Wow, I could get a free bass. And under contract, they were supposed to give me two. They only made me one. They never made me my second one. But they made me a custom Warlock that was personalized. It had a very unique paint pattern. They said, "What color you want?" I said, "I don't know. Give me everything you've got," which is what they did. They put every color over every color, mm-hmm. and they put this black. This is a new paint quality paint. Black crackle. They put it over the color, and it would crackle up and dry that way. So they did that for me. And it had DiMarzio pickups in it, and the thing kicked ass.
Must have had a lot of gain.
It did, yeah. And it was two P-style pickups.
Right.
And whoever it was in the paint department, I don't remember who did this, but it was an awesome idea, and I'd like to get it done professionally to my Thunderbirds, is they drilled out all the side fret markers, and they filled them with tritium paint so that no matter what stage lighting you're in, even when the lights are off, you can see where all your fret markers are because they glow in the dark.
Oh, very cool.
The tritium absorbs the light so strongly, and it's like having little diodes, LED diodes, in the side of your neck, which now the Warwick's Bass Company does. They actually have electronic diodes.
Yeah.
Looks like an airport runway.
Alembic used to do that.
Yeah.
Which was very cool. That tritium, that's an interesting thing.
Yeah. It's a nice touch. Yeah. So I played the Warlock from after the Aria stuff. For many years, I played my Warlock bass everywhere. Recorded with it, played it on stage and whatnot. And then around 2009, 2010, in the back of my mind, I was always looking for a white Thunderbird. Ever since I saw Pete over in Watts in Matahubel, mm-hmm. he had white thigh-high platform boots and this white Thunderbird bass. And the Thunderbird bass is essentially a rounded version of the Explorer or Destroyer body.
Right.
And I always like to play guitars that look like they're moving, even when they're standing still. And it suggests movement in some capacity.
So, well, the other guy that used to have that shape, he had what he called his fender birds, was the On Whistle.
Yeah,
exactly. But it was like it had that shape with the fender. I remember seeing
it. Or it was a reverse Firebird.
Yeah.
And I walked into, of all places, Best Buy in Pacoima. And they had a wall of guitars. It looked like Guitar Center. And they had a Thunderbird bass, but it was the tobacco sunburst color. They said they couldn't get any in white. They said that Japan bought up the whole market of white Thunderbirds. So the guy looked me up on the internet. And he saw my and he sold me the bass, and he gave me a discount and whatnot. So I was playing the tobacco sunburst Thunderbird for a few years, and then about a year or so ago, I'm sitting in my living room and I'm practicing, and my wife had gone out and disappeared for a couple hours. She comes back and she peeks around the fireplace, and I see this black bag, kind of with her peeking around, and I see an inch of the headstock sticking out. And she starts to come out from behind the fireplace. And I said, "No, you did not. No, you did not." And she pulls the bag, because they didn't have a case for it. She pulls the black bag out, and there's the white Thunderbird. And I was like a kid at Christmas time.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, yes, I finally. You know, Nikki Sixx had one, an early mm-hmm. Motley mm-hmm. Crue. And he had the pentagram on it.
Now, was this one that you have here?
Which?
That your wife got you?
Yes.
This is an Epiphone.
Epiphone, yeah.
Yeah.
Nikki offered to sell me his Gibson Thunderbird. I didn't have $600 at the time, which is a steal.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
A few years later, Jeff Pilson offered to sell me his white Thunderbird Gibson. Same price, $600. I didn't have the money. So the opportunities came and went. Now I got an Epiphone, and I went over to EMG, and I asked Tommy, I said, "Can you guys set me up with some EMG pickups?" They're like the best pickups probably in the world, in the market, arguably. I mean, you have your Seymour Duncan people, your DiMaggio people, whatever. I always wanted EMG pickups.
They're good pickups.
They're like the best. And he set me up. He gave me a pair of Thunderbird EMG bass pickups, and I put them in. And this I played at a benefit that for Shredding for a Cure in Long Beach at the Gas Lamp mm-hmm. Club. It was for raising awareness and money for autism. It was one of the charity benefits I do. And I went to plug the thing in, and the guy's standing there going, "Holy crap!" He goes, man, that thing is alive. I said, that's just pure pickups, man. It's EMGs.
No, they're beautiful.
So,
I told you this would go by fast. We're out of time already. But before I let you go, tell people how to get a hold of you in terms of and find out what you're up to and what you're doing. Because they should, you got to see him live. I mean, he's a great, the bass playing is great, but you got to hear him cranked. I mean, we have a little teeny amp, and I'm running him direct in here, but you really need to hear him with a good solid.
I do have to tip my hat to GHS Strings, to Chris Walters, for taking care of me. I've been endorsing the strings since 83, 84. So I have.
Which ones are you using, boomers?
The bass boomers, medium scale. I've been using them for a couple of decades now, and they're my favorite strings.
Now, how can they get a hold? Rick Fox is on Facebook.
I have three different pages on Facebook. There's a Rick Fox page, then there's a Rick Fox page musician, which is linked to Wikipedia, and then I have a Rick Fox fan page, which is we have it set up as secret. So because there's so many people like to infiltrate. And start drama. So,
right.
So we screen people. But yeah, I have three
okay.
pages.
And so, but check out what he's doing. And then, real quick, because we got to go, I want to play this last clip. Gypsy Brandy. First of all, we just barely scratched the surface. So you have to come back.
Yeah, we didn't
that's
school
a given.
Days,
yeah. That's a yeah. We didn't even get into that.
And the Steeler song or whatever, Abduction.
So, but anyway, we're gonna play Gypsy Brandy from Thunderball's, the name of the band. So just set that up, what you're doing on there, and then that will take us out.
Okay. It's essentially starts with a walk. I'm just walking on G. Drums come in, but the bam, but the bam, but the bam, 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 as your Cozy Powell riff. And Joey just cranks. He goes, wah. I said, give me what sounds like slide guitar without playing slide.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what he did. He'd hit these chords, and with the whammy bar, go, wah, 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 wah. And he'd ride those passing chords over my run like that. And then I do this. This wall. It's kind of a Spanishy kind of a walk over that, and that just sets up for the verses. When we get into the choruses, it's much heavier.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a
this thing's a wall of guitars. Yeah. This is Joey, and he's really good.
This is one of my attempts at producing and co-engineering.
Everybody have a great week. Again, Rick, I can't thank you enough for being on the show.
Thank
you, Jeff. And we'll definitely have you back because there's way more to talk about. But this is Gypsy Brandy. Everybody have a great week and just enjoy some great rock.